Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're starting a little bit casually, a little bit behind schedule, but everybody's eating and that's fine. And Bill and I are finally here, and that's good. And Jay came early. Let's hear it for Jay for being a minute. He's the youngest one of us, so he gets up earlier.
It's true.
But Jayden pointed something out. We did not officially have an AA meeting yesterday because Jayden pointed out we did not pray ourselves out of here last night. So we're going to do some meditation this morning before we start. On the program today, the first thing we're going to discuss is how we met our sponsors and what they did with us. I can't say some of the stuff that Bill did because I'm sworn to secrecy, but then we'll have a Q&A, and you can ask us questions about last night or this morning's sessions or anything you want. Yes. But Jay's going to start us off. I'll set the timer for 3 minutes, and then we'll say the Serenity Prayer so Jayden knows he's at an AA meeting. All right, hold on. So if you all get comfortable, close your eyes whenever you're ready, Jay. God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Should I lead off so that it builds?
Yeah, whatever. I don't care any way you want to do.
Yeah, I think that's the way we should.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
Jay Alcoholic.
Hey, Jay.
So, I came to you on the second day of May in 1979, and Alcoholics Anonymous was a much different organization back then. The organization wasn't different, but the consciousness in the public mind was very, very different. AA was basically known from the days of Wine and Roses. There was not the... there was not the access to recovery. It was still pretty much a secret society. You came to Alcoholics Anonymous generally in real trouble. You weren't referred here. I think the biggest difference is that most people now come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they're referred by some kind of professional. Back in 1979, the people that referred you to Alcoholics Anonymous were generally police, and maybe, but it was a much different time. So the AA that I came into, another thing was the format. There was meetings at noon and meetings at 8:30 at night, and
I hear music.
Let's see. Would everybody please turn off their phone or at least put it to in airplane mode?
I can't believe he did that.
He's leading by example.
Thank you. So the AA that I came into, there were lots and lots of new people and lots of 12-step calls. Generally, the way that people came to Alcoholics Anonymous is they would call the central office, and then somebody would be sent out to go and talk to them and bring them to a meeting. Much, much different. There wasn't the internet so that people could find the meetings as easily, so it was all done on the phone. And so I called in. I mentioned yesterday about how I called in and I ended up at my first meeting. And that's basically how things happen. So here I am in AA. I'm at that first meeting. I look up on the wall and I see the steps and the traditions and I'm just going, oh my God, this is the lamest thing that ever happened to anybody in history. a hipster like me has ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my God. And but I also realized that I had been given every opportunity that a man could have. And the best I could do with that gift of being born in the United States at this time and everything was that I ended up in AA. There had to be a real problem here, and the problem probably had to do with me. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to try this thing. I'm going to completely try this thing because I'd never completely tried anything. I just... And so I'm 3 days sober, and I'm sweating on a naga hide couch, and this woman walks in, and she had a bun in her hair, and I think I should say, the night before, Friday night, there was a dance at the Alano Club. I'm 2 days sober, and I'll go vibrating into the dance. And I got the good t-shirt on, and there's women like the women here today. I mean, they've, like, showered and everything. And they're swinging their hips, and I realize that I don't have any drugs in my pocket, and I don't have a drink in my hand, and I'm 24 years old, and I'm never going to get laid again in my entire life. So I get into the Pinot that I'd been living in, and I drive, and I start driving towards the Stickenstein. I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to find a woman who understands. And on the way, the first miracle happens. The voice says, "This is not a good idea. Turn the car around." Now, I've heard that voice all of my life. But I always thought that sounds like somebody trying to tell me what I ought to do. And I'm not going to pay attention to it. I'd go and do whatever the... But this time I turn the car around. And I grabbed this guy, Larry, and he was working the hinge at the dance, and I said, "Talk program to me, please." I've had to do that 3 or 4 times in the 36 years that I've been with you. Just get somebody and say, "Talk program to me, please. I'm in trouble. Help." Okay? So this guy stopped what he was doing. He got somebody else to watch the hymn. She got me a copy of the Big Book. I'd been too cool to get a Big Book, right? Didn't want to look like I was going to Bible study. Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sent me home. I start reading the book, and I'm reading and sweating and smoking and reading and sweating and smoking, and I don't understand what's going on, I finally get to the point where I'm in We Agnostics, and I understood the story at the end of We Agnostics. It's Fitz Mayo's story. Fitz Mayo was the third guy sober in New York, and Fitz had been a preacher's son, and his story's is in the book. And anyway, he tells the story of getting down on his knees. The voice says to him, "Who are you to say there is no God?" I understood that. And this guy got down on his knees and said a prayer, and he had a white light experience, and he never and he was very fundamental in the creation of what we know as Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did what that guy did. I understood the story. So I got down on my knees and I said my prayer. My prayer was, I don't know from Jesus or Buddha, I don't know the Talmud, the Torah, the Upanishads. Just please get me the top. I'll do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Just please help me not to drink. And I believe now at that moment I'd done the first 3 steps. That prayer was perfect. I'm with you this morning. So then I go to the Alano Club. I'm sitting there and I'm smoking, sitting on a naga hide couch, stuck to it, right, because I'm a brawn. This woman walks in, and she's got a bun in her hair and black dress on. She looks like she's been to mass 8,312 times. She says, "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you? How can you tell?" She said, "I didn't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in 4 words. What are they? Find God or die." Not that. Oh, please, not that. 36 years later, I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. Find God and live. Live wondrously. Live abundantly. And when I say God, please don't be confused with what it is you think I might be saying. I'm talking about an experience that I've had within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm hanging a single word that's simple to say. That's it. But when I talk about God for the rest of this weekend, I'm talking about an experience that I've had within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So this woman terrifies me. I go into the noon meeting. There's a guy taking a cake for 4 years. I ask him to sponsor me because I need backup from these kinds of whack jobs, right? And so it starts out. And I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never will be able to repay that man and his Al-Anon wife. They literally saved my life. And So we start getting together once a week, and he'd ask me what I'm doing and this and that and another thing. And by the time it's week three, I mean, like, this is the kind of shape I'm in. I would show up at his doorstep baffled at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The noon meeting's been over for an hour and a half. Whoever I went to coffee's gone home or off to work or something, and I'm just like, and I would go and I would sit on my sponsor's porch sometime and just wait for him to come home, sit there and smoke. His wife would get home first, and she'd open the door, and she'd put on a pot of coffee, and she'd let me sit there and wait until my sponsor came home from work. That is love. That is love. And anyway, when I had 3 weeks sober, back in 1979, you could read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous unsupervised.
Dangerous times.
Really? Really? That's why they had to come out with a fourth edition. Anyway, but anyway, so I'm reading, and I mean, this is how toasted I am. We would go from the meeting at noon down to the beach and sit there and read AA literature back and forth to each other because we didn't know what to do, Lifeguard George and I. And we'd, because we were just without, I was really, I needed help. And anyway, I'm reading, and I'm about 3 weeks sober, and I see in chapter 5 where if we don't do an inventory, we may drink. We may never get over drinking. So I run to my sponsor, I go, I'm going to drink. He goes, no, you're not. You're not going to drink. But he said, why do you say that? And I showed him. He goes, oh, that. And so he gave me my four-step guide. It was two pieces of paper with a line down the middle of each. And he and his buddy told me some really disgusting things about themselves. I was, you know, and then he sent me home with my instructions on doing my inventory. These were the instructions he gave me. He said, kid, get yourself really jacked up on coffee. So this is before Starbucks. You had to brew the stuff, and then you had to drink it. So it took a while to get, you know, ramped up. And then he said, what I want you to do is I want you to sit at the kitchen table. He said, I want you to look at the door. He said, I want you to think about every place that you ever lived. I want you to think about your family members, where you went to school, where you worked. And I want you to, in your mind's eye, just have a parade of these people walking through the door. And anytime somebody walks through that door and your stomach tightens, write down their name. And then you get three sentences as to why, because nobody's life's that interesting, kid. And then he said, I want you to write down what you're afraid of. Write down the sexual weirdness. He said, we're only impressed if it involves invertebrates. And then he said, you know, want to know what you've done with them, who you stole the money from and all that stuff. So write that stuff down. Now, was this a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all four columns? No. It was the greatest hits. Okay. What I wrote down on that first inventory was all the stuff that went, when I put my head on the pillow, went around and around and around and around and around and around and around in my mind. That's the stuff that needs to be on the inventory, that first one.
Well, what about all the other deep stuff that may be dwelling down within me?
It'll get in contact with you. You don't have to worry about it. But what we want to do is we want to get those big things out of the way. And so you write that. So I wrote that stuff down, got together with my sponsor. You know, I mean, it's like what I'm afraid of her, her mother, her sister,
her dog.
You know, I mean, Yavapai County Sheriffs. I mean, there's this thing that somehow the inventory is supposed to be difficult. Poppycock. Number one, the steps are designed for alcoholics. We're about that deep. Okay? Sam Shoemaker, who was Bill Wilson's spiritual advisor, said there's only one sin.
Which one?
Thinking that we're different from our fellows. Now, the reason that I believe that alcoholism is a disease more today than I did when I wrote that first inventory is because I've heard a lot of fifth steps. And they're all the same. Some are a little more boring than others. But we're alcoholic males. There's only so many things we can do to destroy ourselves. We just aren't that creative. And I think for my sisters in the fellowships, it may be the same thing, you know. And so you get that stuff down that I think is so awful about me that makes me so different. And then I got together with my sponsor the next day and I read it to him. And he listened, and then we said a silly prayer or two, and then I burned it.
Oh no, what happened to your eighth step? You know, your
this stuff is the stuff that it's accessible, you know. And we burned it. He tells me to go spend a couple hours down at the beach. I went and did that. We got together later. I did the silly prayers with him. And then he sends me out to start doing my amends. I'm 24 days sober, and I'm a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the first person ask me to sponsor him when I was 28 days sober. I called my sponsor. I said, "What do I do? What do I say?" He said, "Jay, you say yes." "Really?" He said, "Jay, if they're sick enough to ask you for help, you can't hurt them." Okay? Nothing is as dangerous as an alcoholic woman or man trying to solve their problems by themselves. You can't hurt them. And I started out trying to work with others. And tried being their friend.
Tried being their director.
None of that was really working. That I mean, I was doing the best I could. And there's this thing about, oh, well, I'm not good at it. Well, Bill Wilson wasn't good at it. None of us are.
I'm pretty good at it.
Decades later. No. It was worth the shot. But the thing that was, the thing is that I got involved and I started doing it. Now, I want to tell you that about 5 years ago, there's this thing called Facebook. And this man, the first man that asked me to sponsor him, I hadn't seen him in 25 years. Or no, 30 years by then. This little thing comes across, "Is this my sponsor?" And the guy's still sober, you know. So, I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with me. It doesn't have anything to do with me, although in the beginning it feels like it. But the thing is that I need to be available. So I start working with people. I'm having a good time with it. And but nobody seems to be quite as twisted as I am. They don't seem as enthusiastic as I am. Why is it that they aren't? I mean, if my sponsor said he was going to be someplace, I showed up there, you know, early, just because I didn't want to miss anything. And but nobody's doing that with me now. You know? So I, so then what I decided was I wanted to grow in effectiveness and understanding. And so I went out and I took four different guys that I admired in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them up and I said, can I take you to lunch? And they all said yes. And at different times I took these guys to lunch. I took a pad of paper and I said, what'd your sponsor do with you? What do you do with your sponsees? And I learned some really good stuff. And so I cobbled it together and tried different things. Now, the great thing about newcomers is they don't know. They're new. Just try shit on them. See what happens. Right? And then see how things work. But the most important thing that I learned is start reading the literature. Now, with my sponsor and the consciousness of the AA that I came into, they literally would say, are you reading the book? That was it. We never talked about the book Alcoholics Anonymous or the 12 and 12 at all. You went to book studies to do that, but with the sponsors, I never heard of it. But what happened is that I started saying, read it, and then come and we'll talk about it. But then I found that they weren't reading it when we'd get together to talk about it. So that's when I started having them read it to me. And in the beginning, I had them read it to me, and that turned out to be a little demeaning. And so it became, and some people, they don't read very well. So it became a thing of I'd read two pages, they'd read two pages, back and forth. And now with people that I sponsor, what we do is we do that with the big book, and we do it with the 12 and 12, and I got guys that I take through the concepts now, not the service manual, but through the pamphlet, through the Concepts Illustrated. But anyway, so that's what my first sponsor did not give me much direction at all, because we were so busy going out and picking up new people. You know, I had a car, so I'd go down to the Alano Club, and they'd say, here's where they are. Go get them. Don't talk to them. You might pollute them. We'll take care of that, but you go get them. And anyway, that's it.
Bill Alcoholic. So I come in 1985. He was 6 years sober, and I'm one of those that he practiced on. I didn't know he didn't know what the hell he was doing.
I knew a lot.
He seemed like he knew what he was doing. A quick story. Some years ago, this friend of mine that I got sober with, he fell in with this Indian guru. A relatively prominent guy in India. And this guy came over to the United States and was giving some talks in the United States. And my friend Wayne just said, let's go hear him. And at Henry Dennison's house. You know? So cool. That's another story. But anyway, we go there, and he gives his talk, and it was very interesting. Wayne is completely enthralled with this guy. You know, it was really fun to watch. And after he gave his talk, we go in this little back room, and there's just the three of us are just sitting there hanging out, talking. And this guy, Ramesh, is a really interesting man, very bright. And so I'm talking away like I do, just yabbering away. And he looks at me, Ramesh, and he starts laughing. And I said, what are you laughing at, man? And he says, I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts.
And I said, why is that? He goes, well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened. And like his description of himself in sober is the same as me. What the hell happened, man? You know, I mean, there's no rational explanation. I'm out there for 22, 23 years just doing it all, you know, and killing myself. And all of a sudden, one day, it stops. You know? I think we have a tendency to give credit to the recovery program that we went through, you know, because we learn a lot there. So clearly it's intellectual understanding, right? I can finally see. If that's true, that we can finally see, what causes us to finally see? Because people have been talking to us for years. I mean, this is nothing new. You know, now we're locked up inside this place and they're talking at us again. You know, why is it different? So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous baffled without really knowing that I'm baffled. You know, I mean, it's like everything's brand new. Everything's new. They've taken away my medication, so absolutely everything I do is brand new. I don't know about you, I could not imagine having sex sober. I mean, how do you do that looking right at him and then talking to him and stuff? You know? You know, what I said, well, I'm going to worry about that later. I'm not addressing this issue at this point. It was like that for me. It was like that. I mean, I was uncomfortable everywhere I was. Without really being aware that I'm uncomfortable wherever I am, I'm just kind of on edge. You know, it's like sitting on a couch that's stuffed with steel wool. You know, everything moves all the time. You know, and that's kind of where most of us, I think, are at some level, you know, where you're just trying to figure it out. You know, I mean, we all stand in the side, away from the crowd a little bit and listen to how everybody's talking and stuff so that we can talk right. You don't want to say the wrong thing, you know. I'm the guy that walks in the room, and if you're looking at me, it's, what the hell are you looking at? And if you're not looking at me, I'm heartbroken. And there's, like, no middle ground, you know. There are not striations of emotions, you know. It's like on, off, on, off. It's like that. 150 times a day, it's like that, you know, flipping the switch. You know, you're pissed off and then you're crying. You know, it's like it's at a roller coaster. So I come in and I go to the gong show, and I'm thinking it was probably within the next 2 weeks. I asked him to sponsor me. Now, he was very prevalent. He was in all the meetings. His wife at the time had just gotten sober. And so everywhere I went, there he was. You know, I mean, we all were hanging at the Ilano Club, and most of the meetings, he was there. You know, he was there at the gong show. He was there at the men's stag meeting. He was, you know, he was always around. And it looked like, and it probably was the case, he knew everybody. He was connected, you know, and he was very enthusiastic. He always had a lot to say. I think that's why I asked him to sponsor me. But I'm not really sure. I mean, it seemed like the right thing to do. And so I said, you know, will you sponsor me? And at the time, I was calling myself an alcoholic and an addict, because they taught me to do that in the recovery place. And trust me, I'm an addict. You know? And so I was doing that, because everybody was doing it. This was like maybe the first big wave of people coming out of recovery places, coming into AA. Unbeknownst to me, I was part of that whole big thing. You know, not calling the central office, but coming in through the recovery industry. And which I have absolutely nothing against. These people are our friends. They're trying to help. We should be integrated with them. We should be part of them. We should understand what's going on. And but there was a lot of animosity towards that when I came in. People were reading newspaper articles in the meetings and talking about spin drives and people making money off of AA, and it made me feel like an outsider. well, I'm just arrogant and pushy enough where it just pissed me off. You know, so I started talking about it a lot just to create havoc. You know, so somebody else, you know, you can chase people out of AA and not even know it. You know, I don't think those opinions belong in the meetings. I ask him to sponsor me. I'm calling myself an alcoholic and addict. He takes me outside the Alano Club. It's at night. And he says, I notice that you call yourself an alcoholic and an addict. I go, well, yeah. He says, well, if you're calling yourself an addict because you think it's a little hipper, slicker, and cooler, you might want to drop it and be like everybody else for the first time in your life. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember standing there, and he's short, if you haven't noticed. And I'm looking down at him, and what was standing in front of me was every goddamn authority figure that has ever been in my life. And I've yelled and railed against all of them. And I looked at him, and that started coming up, and I just went, okay. I mean, when you end up in AA, there's just no argument anymore. I mean, my friend Scott Redmond says that Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I did not know was available. You know? I mean, this is not where the hip people are. The hip people are still out there, you know. And I remember driving home that night being kind of pissed off, and then I thought to myself, how did he know? How did he know that I was trying, once again, to separate myself from the group, not be just like all of you? And I thought also, you know, this is going to be difficult. This guy, he didn't ask me any questions about myself. He didn't ask me where I came from to get kind of a feel for my case so that he could approach me in a certain way that would be helpful to me and make the transition into AA a little more smooth. You know? He was never, he's still not like that, you know? And but I showed up at his house Thursday at 5 o'clock. And at the time, he hadn't gotten to the point of where, you know, I read a page and you read a page. He just had me sit there and read it to him out loud, you know, and he listened. And every so often he would stop me and bring something to my attention because he had a book. He was following along, right? And I really liked that. It was like going to class. And I could ask him questions and stuff. We were alone together in the room. This is what most of us that don't sponsor people try to avoid, is being alone with another human being and actually having to truly interact without any outside stimulus at all. It scares the shit out of us. You know, it's called intimacy. You know, sponsoring people is a very intimate thing. And you're not conscious of that at the time. But as the years go by and those defenses fall away, my insecurities decrease, I'm able to get closer and closer and closer to you because I'm less afraid. And when I jokingly said that I think I'm better at it, I'm just better at getting close to you. I know now that you cannot hurt me. Why would you? You know, I mean, I just don't have anything to defend. There's nothing to protect anymore. Everybody knows everything about me, which is kind of embarrassing, you know, but there's nothing to hide. There's nothing to defend. And he's always been very much that way with me. Very, talk to me, you know, you can talk to me. And God, I'm a talker. And he would stop me and say, what chapter are we on? Let's get back to, you know, and he'd keep me on track. And each week we read another chapter in the book. And he skipped the third step with me. He did not make me get on my knees and hold his hands and pray, which I didn't know that you were all doing that, you know, anyway. So I didn't know that anything got skipped. More about that later. I did my inventory, and I came over to do my fifth step, and I walked up to his house, knocking on the door, and I hear somebody yell, and he's sitting out on the beach in a beach chair, and he's got another Chair, now this is Southern California. There's thousands of goddamn people on the beach, right? And this fifth step should be done in dark rooms with kind of music in the background or something, you know? This is heavy stuff. He says, come on out here. And he had a pad with him, you know, and I sat there and I did my fifth step in public with this stranger. A stranger. We didn't really know each other. We'd known each other for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. It's about how long it takes to get to the fifth step. And I did my fifth step. And then he asked me, he says, is there anything that you've left out that you're not going to tell me? Tell me now. So I told him about the vacuum cleaner. You know, which is not like robbing a bank or murdering people. It's like weird stuff that you do when nobody's looking. Nobody ever needs to know about the vacuum cleaner, you know? Why in God's name did I tell him about the vacuum cleaner? Years later, we're in The Hague in the Netherlands. Remember that? And we're walking around, there's all these museums, and there's a vacuum cleaner museum.
Porn.
And we went in and we found pretty much the kind of vacuum cleaner, you know. Took some pictures next to it. He told me, he says, there will come a day in your life where you will share all of this from the podium. And some of it's not really appropriate, so you don't, but there's nothing anymore that has any power over me. That person that I used to be, or that kid that was experimental, all the stuff, all the dark stories that I've carried around that caused me to feel less about myself, there's no more power in any of them. Isn't that odd? You know what that's called? Freedom. Freedom. Freedom happens here. And he told me to go be quiet, go reflect for an hour on the work that I'd done, and if there was anything I left out, to call him later. And he said another thing to me that was, it was a real experience. He says, when you walk back in the door of your house, think about the guy that walked through that door 6 months ago or whenever it was, and the guy who's walking through the door now. And literally, I came home and the wife and kids were gone, and I had to stick the key in the lock to unlock the door, which is odd, really. And I unlocked the door, and I took a moment, and I thought about it, and you know what struck me? The obsession had been lifted, and I had not noticed. I'd been busy, you know, trying to figure out how to get along at AA, and intrigued by the whole experience, and I had not noticed. And I said the first real prayer that I'd probably maybe ever had said, and that was, I invited God over for a barbecue. I didn't know what else to do, you know. I didn't get on my knees, and I didn't, you know, it wasn't anything heavy. It was just like, I think you'd like this house. It's kind of nice here now. Nobody's screaming and yelling, and it's quiet. And sometime after that, I called him up, and the first annual South Bay Roundup was going on. And
so it was June.
Wasn't it August? It was June. Yeah, the first one anyway. And he was down there working a booth, you know. I didn't even know if I was going to go or not. He told me to go, but, you know. And I called him up, and I left him. He called me back, and I said, I've got a problem, man. I need to talk. I got a real problem going on. And he says, well, come down to the Roundup. Come down to the Marriott. I'll meet you there. So I drive down there, and we're in the lobby of this big hotel, the Marriott Hotel in Torrance, and we're sitting there, and I'm going on, I forget what the problem was. I don't remember. We're going on, And he interrupted me. He says, "Do you want me to pray with you?" And I said, "Yeah, would you please?" Because the whole God thing is stupid, right? It's just stupid, and they suck you into it, and pretty soon you're walking around going, "God, God, 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 God." And I just didn't like it. It bothers me to this day when somebody gets up at the podium and just, "God this and God that," and you're just like, "God, would shut the hell up," you know? It's like, you're just like whistling in the dark, hoping maybe if I say it enough times, it'll happen, you know? It's like, that was my attitude, just really not good. He told me one time, he said, "Your opinion is absolutely irrelevant. We don't need you here. You need us." I thought that was cold. Yeah. So this admission to him, this was a big deal for me. He said, "Do you want me to pray with you?" And I said, "Would you please?" And he goes, "Well, let's do it right here." And we're in the lobby. People are. And I looked at him and I went, "Please don't make me do that." Because I would have done it. At that point, I would have done it. And he took me around the corner. Every year I go to the roundup, I go visit the shrine. We sat in this chair in this hall, in this bench in the hallway. And I think he put his arm around me and we breathed a little bit. And he said, "You know, breathe God in and breathe your problems out," and that kind of stuff. And we did the third step. I later asked him, I says, "Why didn't you do the third step with me when we were reading the book?" He says, "Because I was afraid you'd come across the table at me." So he waited. So sponsorship is not etched in stone. You know, it's not etched in stone. I hear some people say, "Well, if a guy can't do a third step, he's just not ready." How do you know? How do you know that? You know, he might be ready, he's just not willing. It's like, you know. Now, today what happens to me today, this has happened several times to me, where we get to the third step and I say to the guy, I go, "Are you ready to do the third step?" And the guy will look at me and he goes, "No." And I go, "Why not?" He goes, "Well, I have a problem with God." I look right at him and I go, "Me too, let's pray." And then I've had a couple of guys say, "Well, I don't even believe in God." I look right at him without missing a beat, and I go, "Nobody really does. Let's pray." You know, because it says right here in this book, pray. You know, now I don't know about you, but I am like out of options. You know, nothing else seems to have ever worked in my life. This is working really well. And these people that I'm following around, they pray and they meditate and they seem peaceful. They seem, their lives are getting better. I mean, the evidence is astounding. The other thing about that, and I know Jay feels much the same way, I mean, we all can come up with a certain theology. We've been raised in certain cultures by people, and some of us have been raised going to church since we were very little. My experience is that most people, if they were raised in a church, they somehow end up back in that church with a completely different attitude than they had before when they were being forced to go. It seemed, because that's where we're from and we're comfortable there. I was raised with nothing, you know, so I don't have any root in that. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is that God is an experience. It's not a concept. And if you do this work, it will happen to you. Now, you can label it whatever you want, you know, or you can just ignore it. You know how people in AA talk about coincidences and everybody laughs because we all know it's God? I'm convinced they're fucking coincidences, you know. And they've been going on forever, and we just were so loaded we never noticed, you know. There's all this stuff that's happening. The universe, by its very nature, is a giving place. We just take exception to what it's giving us. We think it should be something different. You know, well, it's not. You know, and once you fall into that, this stuff starts to unfold right in front of you. It's always been unfolding, but I just rejected it. But I've had some powerful experiences in AA, mostly around sponsoring people. Mostly it's been between me and one other person in a room alone, mostly. There's been other ones. But these are powerful human experiences that are hard to ignore. Hard to ignore. At the time, am I doing okay? At the time that all this was going down, people were starting to take meetings to Russia. And somehow I got on the mailing list for the little newsletter they were putting out. And I looked at that and I go, you know, I've got some money now. I could go to Russia, carry the message, you know. And I go to Jay and I go, you know, man, I'm going to go to Russia and carry the message. He looks at me and he goes, why don't you go to Oregon and make your amends? Killjoy. Back on track. Where'd we leave off? Ninth step. Well, we'll get around to it, you know. So I've never been to Russia. I've been to Oregon a bunch of times, you know. And I went up to Oregon and I made my amends to that first ex-wife and those kids and a doctor up there and some other people and, you know, started the process of cleaning it up, trying my best to clean it up. And I can tell you today I have a really good relationship with that ex-wife. And my second ex-wife, her and I are like brother and sister, you know. I mean, we're together a lot. We always were kind of like brother and sister. And there's been a lot of forgiveness, you know, that has come from her. You know, I never walked away from that family. I never walked away from them. I told them I'm not going anywhere. I'm still here. I'm right here. And I paid the money like clockwork every month. You know, sent my daughter to college and did what we're supposed to do, you know. And I walked in there, and there's no one else to blame. And I just took the heat. Started showing up to the soccer games. All the soccer moms quit talking to me. This one woman was on the side of the field one day, and she forgot that she didn't like me. And she started talking to me. We had this nice conversation, and I could see in her eyes where she realized she had screwed up. And she just kind of stopped and turned away. Mary, my ex-wife, calls me a day or two later, and she says, I heard you had a nice little conversation with Debbie. And I said, yeah, she forgot she didn't like me. You know? And Mary laughed, and she goes, yeah, she said to me, she goes, you know, he's not such a bad guy. And Mary said, yeah, he's hard to hate, isn't he? So here's the key, man. Be hard to hate. Because if they hate you, it's probably for good cause. So if you start changing and just be real cute, pretty soon they'll forget they hate you. You know, there'll be these little gaps of hate. And, you know, we know about hate, don't we? You ever hated somebody really bad, and on a certain day you forget to hate them, so the day after that you got to double up on it because you skipped a day, you know? Because, you know, they feel it. We feel it. I made my amends, and I'm sponsoring people. And I've had the same sponsor for 31 years. Yeah. I should have fired him many times, but he needs me now. And, we started doing stuff together. We started speaking together. We started doing workshops together. It's been a real blessing. He talks about going to Coe, Switzerland, to the headquarters of the Initiatives of Change, which is the old Oxford group. And my wife and I went with him and Adele. It was an incredible experience. You know, those people are very aware of us, of their roots of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're very proud of that. And it was a powerful experience. They've been around a good portion of the world doing AA stuff. All of us have. And what an incredible life. Who would have ever guessed? Who would have ever guessed that it would be this abundant, you know? And I'll tell you something, just to close quickly. Doing inventories and doing the work is important stuff. We need to do that so that we have a message that has depth and weight. How can we guide someone through the process if we have not done it ourselves? AA is about experience, not opinions and concepts. It's about experience. Now, if you have some opinions, hopefully they're based in experience that you've had, and you're trying to verbalize it. You know, true wisdom is experience combined with intellect. And if I can verbalize my experience, maybe you'll learn something from it. If I can learn to listen to you, I will learn from your experience, your life experience. When you come here, you haven't been asleep the whole time. You know some stuff. Things have happened to you. And you need to tell me. Part of my job is to listen to that. Everything changes when you go from reading a fifth step to your sponsor to when you start listening to them and you're now the sponsor. The whole game changes. I mean, completely. It is a completely different program. 1 through 9 is about 10%, maybe 15% of the program, max. And we suffer over it. We've got 87 column expanded versions of the inventory. We got manuals and workbooks and stuff. And to me, a lot of this is just another form of self-obsession. We're just working on ourselves and working on yourself on ourselves. Here's some advice for you. Here's an opinion from Bill C. Stop working on yourself. It's a waste of time. You don't need to dredge up your character defects and work on them. They will visit you with alarming regularity. You know, and you'll be so confronted with them, you cannot ignore them. And you know how you confront them? Working with others. Every defect of character you have will present itself. You know? When I started listening to the fifth steps, the whole game changed. I don't go to 7 or 8 or 10 meetings a week anymore. I have a life. You know, if you've been sober some time, like 5, 10, 15 years, and you're still going to 87 meetings a week, there's something wrong. You know? What happens is people call. People come to the house now. You know, in between the meetings I go to, I'm working with these guys. That's why we're here. Everything else is an activity. This is the real action, is reaching out and trying to work with others, as I was worked with. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Matt the Alcoholic, the opinions expressed at this table are not necessarily the opinions of Alcoholics Anonymous. We just wanted you to be clear on that. I do have an experience
with
God. And I will, no, I loved everything I've heard, and it's a pleasure to be here again today. And one of the things I wanted to say before I start talking about how I was sponsored is, you know, Sandy Beach is a guy I love. He passed away recently. But he said over and over, and Bill touched on it, this is a map. This is a map to a treasure. And around here, a lot of people memorize the map, and they never go to the treasure, right? You have to take the steps on the map to get the treasure. Knowing the map isn't the treasure. And I've heard a lot of times in AA meetings, sponsorship's not mentioned in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, yeah, if you're looking for the word sponsorship in the map, it's not mentioned. But if you start, and the doctor's opinion is where I start, in the letter the doctor wrote, in the third paragraph, he says, in the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his concept to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship. Sponsorship's in the very first part of the big book, unless you're trying to memorize a map. And so that's what we're up here to talk about. Bill used to say all the time, I'm surprised it hasn't come up yet, he said, you don't have to give it away to keep it. Everybody says you get to step 12, you give it away to keep it. You give it away to get it, right? Yeah. And that's why we come here. That's what we want to talk about, because we keep getting it. And it's amazing, you know. It's like getting more skillful at truly helping other people is getting more skillful at the art of life. Because we're all connected to each other. You know, I one of the great awakenings for me, like Bill talks about God without even knowing he's talking about God, right? Experiences. God isn't the dancer, he's the dancing, right? And so I've had all these experiences and learned to accept that they come when I turn into God. Like the 11th step has a beautiful line. Were we looking for what we could pack into the stream of life? That means the stream. Streams go in one direction. You get to pack in, or were you trying to get stuff for yourself, swimming upstream? That direction to me is the open-heartedness of the experience of consciousness unfolding, or a power greater than myself, or I like to call it the timeless plenitude of being. And my journey in sponsorship has been continually being right-sized enough and opened enough by all the things Bill and Jay have talked about to constantly have a connection and a presence with that, and to know when I don't, if I'm off a little bit. And I came in, I told you, I asked a guy at a meeting, my third or fourth meeting, guy named John. He was really weird because I was raised by a family that taught me to be polite, and they said, if someone asks you a question, you don't answer with a question. And I asked this guy, will you be my sponsor? And he answered with a question. He said, do you have a job? Which seemed to me a completely irrelevant question. But now that I've sponsored a lot of guys, I totally understand why he asked me that. And I said, no, I don't have a job. And he gave me his first direction. He said, get a job. And like an idiot, I said, what kind of job should I get? I have no idea why I thought he was Kelly's temporary services all of a sudden. And he looks at me and he goes, the kind with a paycheck. Which was great advice because it broadened my field. I could find, my narrow field was drying up, and I got a job, you know, like I said, at midnight to 4 a.m, stacking newspapers on a loading dock, and that job was not beneath me. Managing a restaurant was beneath me a few years before that. Stacking papers on a loading dock was just perfect, thank you. My brain was jello, you know, I needed some time. And I smoked Camel cigarettes and said the Serenity Prayer on the loading dock on my breaks, because I was fried, man. I was not in good spirits. Then I went home to my mom's and dad's house. In time for breakfast. You know, humbling, humbling, humbling. And I went to a lot of meetings, and I talked a little bit the other day about some of the important lessons my sponsor gave me, but one of the most fundamental things he did, and Bill taught me this again later, is he did not get involved in my drama. You know, I had a baby across town with this girl, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to move forward. My mom's dying of cancer. I owe everybody thousands of dollars. I have warrants out for my arrest. That was a good sponsorship story. I'll tell you this. 60 or 90 days sober, I'm driving home from a meeting, and there's smoke coming out of my tailpipe because one of my drug buddies, I don't know who at this time, had put sugar in my gas tank. I don't know why. I'm sure I earned it. But I'm driving, and there's smoke coming out of my tailpipe, and the police pull me over, and I'm like, oh, God, you know, I don't have insurance. I don't know where the registration is. I have a license, but it's been expired for several years. And he says, can I see your license and insurance? And I said, you know, officer, I just got a 90-day chip today in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, oh, can I see your license and registration? So I found the registration to this piece of crap car, and I handed him my license, and I'm looking at the expiration date, doing math in my head, which I've never been good at. And he looks at it and looks at me and goes, I'll be right back. And he goes to his car, and I'm playing lighting Camel cigarettes and saying the Serenity Prayer. And he comes back to the car, and he goes, can you step out of the car, please? And I said, I'm 90 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, welcome to your past, Mr. Mitchell. Get out of the car and put your hands behind your back. And I got locked up on Friday evening, and my parents were in another country, and I was in jail till Monday morning. And when they chained me up to go out to see the judge, the guy next to me, and I'm not kidding, pulled crack out of his underwear and smoked it on a table as we're waiting to go out. And I'm going, God, grant me the serenity. Please. This is bullshit. And my sober brother is 12 years sober, and the mother of my daughter is standing side by side in the court. And I walk out, and my brother starts laughing because I'm chained to these skinheads, and my girlfriend starts crying. And I get home from jail, I have to walk to my car. Somebody had now taken and smashed it up onto the sidewalk. That's happened while I was in jail. Someone hit it repeatedly with a car. So I don't know who it is who hates me out there. but somebody does. So I drove my Mr. Magoo accordion car with a singer coming out to my mom's and dad's house. I unlocked the door. I haven't slept for 3 days because I've been in jail. I walk in, the phone rings. I pick up the phone. It goes, "Hey, it's Officer Smith from the Redondo Beach Police Department." I go, "Oh, Jesus Christ, what now?" And he goes, "Ha, I'm just effing with you. It's your sponsor." And I said, "Dude, that's not funny. I've been in jail for 4 days." And he goes, "I know." And I go, "How do you know?" And he goes, "Because I drove by you while they were arresting you." And I said, "Well, why didn't you help me?" And he goes, "I'm not walking up on a cop when they're running your traffic. I'm not doing that." And I go, he goes, "What are you going to do right now?" I said, "I'm going to go to bed." He goes, "No, you're going to get dressed. You're going to go to the meeting." And I said, "No, I'm not." And he goes, "Yeah, you're going to go to the meeting and you're going to tell them what happened." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm going to bed." And I couldn't imagine telling my few friends in AA what a punk loser I was. I couldn't do it. And he goes, "Well, all right, go to bed and find yourself another sponsor." So now, I've already told this guy some stuff. So I'm going to have to kill him. And then my fifth step's going to be a lot harder. So I took a shower and I got dressed and I thought, well, I'll go to the meeting, but I'm not going to share what happened, right? And at this meeting, they had involuntary sharing, so you get called on. So I'm just being as small as I possibly can be, and my sponsor goes, "Call on Matthew." So I shared what happened, and I was so embarrassed. I'm still embarrassed thinking about it, which is so ridiculous. And I shared, and then what happened before happened again. Somebody goes, "Man, I remember when I got arrested sober." And he started sharing, and he started sharing, and he started sharing, and I healed inside. And my spot, I came up, and I go, "I don't know why I got arrested." He goes, "Because God wants you to pay your warrants." And that's what happened. I did like 56 hours of community service. This is how lame I am. I got sentenced to 60 hours of community service, but by the deadline, I had only done 52. I had one more day of community service. Standing by the side of the freeway with an orange jumpsuit on and people throwing their Coca-Cola cans at you, calling you a loser while I drive to work. That's what I did every day. And I go up to the court clerk and I say, because my sponsor says, "Well, don't just let it lapse. Go tell him." So I went and said, "Hey, I was supposed to do 60 hours. I did 52 hours. And he goes, "Oh, okay, let me check your case number." And he checks my case number to the clerk and he goes, "You weren't sentenced to any community service." I'm always right on top of the details. So anyway, so then we talked about fifth steps here, and my sponsor, not Bill again, you know, he says, "Look, I want you to do a fifth step, and here's four columns, and this is how you do it." And we read the written example in the big book, and I just couldn't get my head around how to do this. And I went to several people and said, "I'm confused about how to do this." And my sponsor heard me say that, and he goes, "I understand your confusion, Matthew. It's the only step in the book that has a written example. I understand why it's baffling to you." So I went home and I just tore up the four columns, and I'm Catholic, so I wrote a general confession of all the crap I'd done that was keeping me up at night. And that I was thinking about, I wrote pages and pages and pages. And then I went to his house and we went down. He had this crazy wife who we'll figure later in the story. So we go down into this rec room, you know, rec room at a apartment complex, but nobody went in there. It smelled like mold and the pool table was warped, and we just sat on the couch. And I start telling him this thing, and I'm crying, and I'm telling him my secrets and my dirty stuff, and I'm crying, and I'm wiping my nose, and he's looking at me. He's not writing anything down, just staring at me. I do all five pages. I'm pretty much lying. I'm like a little tiny crumpled up leaf, and he goes, "That was awesome. That was fantastic. It wasn't a fifth step, but it was awesome." I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "What happened to the four columns? What happened to the written example? What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I don't understand. I just told you all my darkest secrets." He goes, "Where does it say in this book, tell somebody your darkest secrets? Let's start again." And he goes, "Write down the name of somebody you're resentful at." And I wrote his name down. I'm like, "You! For not stopping me before I got all teary and snotty and sending me home." And I went home and I had a completely different experience. And my brother did something that Bill said. My brother's sober, right? And I said, "I'm just confused about these resentments." He goes, "Hey, man, you're in a room. There's no windows. There's just a door. Who do you not want to see come through that room?" And I just started writing. There's a lot of people on that list. And, you know, I want to say something. This is sort of my opinion, but Dr. Paul backs me up. Sometimes we put ourselves on our four steps, right, because we have guilt. Guilt is a resentment against yourself. Almost 100% of the time, guilt is associated with another human being. It's much more beneficial to put their name. They're all you. They're all you. So I did some things to some people that I couldn't believe I'd done. And I felt guilty about it. I wasn't resentful against them at all. I harmed them, some of them irreparably. And I wrote their name. And I wrote what took place. And I wrote how it affected me. And I wrote my part. And I was free. And you know, when I did my fifth step with that sponsor, I managed some Marie Callender's. I told you that. I managed it into the ground. And I never stole money from that place, but another manager knew the reputation I had, so he came and let himself into the safe on my shifts, and he stole money from that place. And he was on my fifth step. And when I got done, they didn't fire him because I took the fall. I was deserved to be fired. But when I got done, I didn't feel relieved in the sunlight of the spirit. I felt sick to my stomach that I'd just done all that. And my sponsor said, let's go out and get something to eat. And we went to Marie Callender's. A different one. And guess who the new manager was? That guy. And I was sitting there, I just did the fifth step, and his face was bright red from drinking. And I couldn't stand looking at him. And he couldn't stand looking at me. That's my experience, you know. And we did the ninth step. My sponsor continually said, you need to sponsor people. You need to sponsor people. And I just felt like I wasn't, I try, you know, I go up and give my number to people. And then he said, why are you giving your number to a guy that's scared to death of AA? Why don't you take his number? And I go, well, what do I say when I call him? He goes, it doesn't matter. Say, how are you doing? And then wait, and the floodgate will open. And I did that. And, you know, and then we did the ninth step, and he was really clear. He gave me some great direction. Really, really sound direction. And one of the things he said is never make an amends without running it by me first. And I did do a couple of amends without running it by him first, and they blew up in my face. Some of them, my motives were wrong. Some of them had to do with women. But I got all this, but the reason he's not my sponsor today, in fact, I was just thinking, Bill, you've been my sponsor for 20 years.
Whoa.
I know. Look how healthy you are. Look how much better you are now. But
dying from liver disease.
Yeah, right. That's the material world. We're going to talk about God some more. So what happened was his girlfriend was a little crazy, and his wife, or I think they got married, and she didn't like somebody named Matthew, but it wasn't me. So, you know, I got a baby. My mother died. The IRS came to the door, and all the chips were getting cashed in. So I was calling a lot in my second year of sobriety, and he never called me back. And I'd say, hey, it's Matthew. Is John there? He's in the shower. He's downstairs, or he's just getting out of his car. I'll tell him you called. And she was purposely not passing my messages along. I'm not a big fan of changing sponsors. I'm not. I just needed someone. So I mentioned this at a meeting, and a friend of Bill's came over and said, I'll sponsor you. And this guy, it's hard to describe, but he's kind of an awakened, enlightened sage. He speaks all over the world on spirituality. And I would sit with him, and he would just smile at me. I'd say, you know, I got this problem, and I don't know what to do about the baby, and I owe the IRS money, and he'd just smile at me. He seemed very calm and at peace. It was not transferring over to my side of the table. And then he did some stuff that I didn't want what he had, and I went to Bill, and Bill was a good friend of his, and Bill was driving to a meeting, and Bill said, hey, don't judge him, but if you need a sponsor that talks to you about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know we joke about this, but he said, I'll do it till you find a sponsor, right? And we drove to the Valley, and that was 20 years ago, and Bill's held my children when they were born. You know? Bill used to complain he didn't have any friends. And I said, Bill, I'm your friend, whether you like it or not. Right? And he said, I have people in AA. And he says, I held your children when they were steaming. You know, my wife has many health problems. You know, she has brain damage, and she's had seizures, and she's gone to the hospital a few times. And my wife's very droll and funny. And she said, whenever I wake up and there's fluorescent lights above me and Bill and Jay are leaning over, I think, oh, shit. Something happened. Yeah. And they think they're the angels of mercy, you know. But Bill said, hey, I don't want to go through the steps with you again in the book. You're sober a while. Let's do a group. and we did the Dr. Paul pamphlet, the unofficial guide to the 12 mm-hmm. steps, and the name of our group was the Seething Cauldron of Debate.
Yeah.
And
it was a great group.
It was a great group. We had a bank robber and a guy who, this one guy in the group, his father had tried to kill himself, and he shot himself through the chin, and the bullet came out the top of his nose and lodged in the roof of his truck. And that guy used to drive that truck to the meeting. So we were a colorful group. You can always tell when an alcoholic is involved in a crime because in the paper it says attempted. But this is what I mean, you know. Bill also was like, go out there and help people, and go. And I got some guys to sponsor, and I started calling him. And Bill will tell you, and I think it's an important thing is, you know, a guy's getting healthier when he stops calling about his problems and starts calling about challenges he's having in sponsorship. Because I said it when I started, but this getting more skillful, you know, Bill and I were talking about a concept. I've been, you know, I'm a big student of religion, and Maya is a Hindu phrase that the world that we know it is an illusion, right? This is all an illusion. The truth is the underlying energy. But I just read this book by a college professor from the 30s, and he said, well, actually the root of Maya is to met out, to measure out, right? So you measure things out and break them up into digestible brain-sized pieces, and you've made an illusion out of the purity of the timeless plenitude of being. What you're seeing is actually the truth. You just don't see it correctly, right? So this is not a bottle. This is a bottle sitting on a table, sitting on the ground, sitting on the planet Earth in space, circling around the sun in this universe. There's nothing separate from anything in the universe, right? So the reason I'm belaboring this point is because almost every problem I've ever had has been a problem of my relations to you. Because partly I believe for a long time I'm separate from you, right? I believe I'm separate from you. That's impossible. You know, I love these people that go, I'm a loner, I'm autonomous. I'm like, really? Walk across the room without air. How separate and autonomous are you? Yeah. Did you make those clothes? Did you kill your dinner? You're not autonomous. You're in a woven web of relationships. Right? I'm a son. I'm a parent. I'm a brother. I'm a friend. Right? So when I said getting more skillful at helping others is getting more skillful at the art of life, I really meant it. These guys have taught me. You know, my son last night at the house that we're staying in said, I need to talk to you. And he asked me advice about where he should spend his summer. His girlfriend's going to be somewhere else. Should he go be with her? Should he stay and work the job he's got? And I'll tell you what, man, I was 100% prepared for that conversation because I sponsored a bunch of people. I listened to their crazy ideas, and I didn't jump their shit because they had crazy ideas. I said, you know, I understand where you're coming from, but I think you might want to think about it this way. I had a guy, you know, when I think about Bill, people have asked me, what's it like for you? What is sponsorship like for you? I go, well, for years I would hand Bill this big knotted up ball of yarn, and he'd look at it for a minute and go, pay attention to this thread right here. And I go, okay, cool, I'm good. And I go, that thread is all I'm thinking about right now, this thread, right? And then all the yarn just kind of shook itself out. You know, Bill talks about his opinions about God. Jay, these guys are like polar opposites when it comes to that kind of stuff. I'm the product of the two of them. But I will say this, and I really mean this. Not believing someone else's experience is true because you have not had that experience yourself will rob you of a beautiful and bright and wide experience of life. If I came in here and didn't believe the things you said about AA, I wouldn't have tried them, right? But I didn't only believe the things you said. I believed the way you lived and the way you laughed without reserve. And the way you didn't look over your shoulder. And the way when you walked into a room, I used to have a look in my eyes. I dated this crazy girl, but man, she was smart. And she said, you walk into a room and you ask yourself, what lies did I tell these people? I can see it in your eyes. That freaked me out. I see you guys come into rooms and not do that, right? So when someone else is telling you about their experience of God, I suggest you don't doubt it. I suggest you be curious about it. And see for yourself. Have the experience for yourself. I've had experiences with these guys. I want to finish with this. You know, long time ago, 17 years ago, actually, Bill could not go speak at a meeting. So he said, hey, Matthew, can you go speak at this meeting? So I went to this meeting up in the valley, And I told my story, and it was a taper. And the taper sent it as the tape of the month that week out. So 3 weeks later, I'm going to Reno to speak at a meeting, right? Because Bill sent me. And now it's everywhere. And I've been speaking for 17 years, once or twice a month, all over the world. And Bill and Jay and I have been lucky enough to accidentally end up at conferences together. We plan things together. But I want to tell you who this guy is. I work for a big biotech company who will remain nameless. And I was in a big room teaching a bunch of people how to do their jobs. And I saw I missed a call from Akron, Ohio. And I laughed and said, I'm probably being asked to speak at Founders Day, right? And I laughed about it. And then I went outside and listened to the message at my break, and it said, hey, this is the committee from Founders Day. We'd like to invite you to speak. And I went, oh, God. Wow, right? So I call Bill, and he's, like, happy for me. You know, he's happy for me. I'm the first guy from our home group that got to do this. And, you know, I went to Founders Day, and they were like, you know, AA will never be organized. They didn't pick me up to bring me to my own talk. And sorry, you guys did a similar thing this morning, but they, it's just how AA is. But you know what? I had someone in my back pocket. You know what? Bill flew to Akron to support me with his wife, to support this guy who's a big national speaker, wanted to be there for me, and sat next to my daughter. There's one funny story about that. My daughter's come to a lot of my talks. She's 15 now, but she's been coming to my talks since she could. But she always puts headphones on and puts on her iPad, right? Because I don't want her to hear daddy abused women and stuff. She probably is savvy enough on the internet now. But so I said, hey, Sophie, this is like the biggest thrill of my life. You know, there's 9,000 people in the stadium. When I get up there to get up, will you take a picture of me doing this? I really want to have a picture. She goes, yeah, daddy, I'll do that. She's sitting next to Bill and Karen. They are sitting on the side. So just, I stand on the podium, I look at Sophie, and I nod, and she goes, oh, and she puts the headphones on. God said, your little ego doesn't need a photograph of this. Sophie forgot to take the picture. We had a great time. And the reason I tell you that story is because this guy changed everything for me. You know, I needed, when I hit the wall, someone who'd hit the wall. I didn't need someone to go to more meetings, you know, be honest. He said, dude, you know what he said when I called him and said, Philip, I had a stroke? He said, they say there's no big deals in AA. There are big deals in AA, and this is one of them. He validated that I was losing it. That's really important. And that's why I knew what to say to my son last night, because I practiced, and I was taught with understanding and love. And one of the things Bill and I did that I'll never forget as long as I live is we had some downtime, and we went to the gatehouse where this guy named Bill talked to this guy named Bob in this really small room, and all of this started. And Bill and I sat there together, a direct descendant of people who gave it away to even get it, people who continually, till they died, mastered the art of helping other people so they could be more skillful at the art of living. And I got to be there with Bill, and I'll never, ever forget it as long as I live. And thanks so much for letting me share. So
I just went to Founders Day to make sure he didn't screw up. And I always tell him, be sure you tell him how much I've done for you.
So 15 break. Yep, yeah. Let's pray for Jaden. You want to lead us in the Lord's Prayer?
Keith?
Come on up. Stand up. Everybody stand up. It's okay.
Here, hold those hands. Kingdom, the power, and glory forever and ever.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
Hey, 15 minutes? 20?
Yeah. Let's a mirror get in here.
Yeah, it is pretty good.